Interrobang.
From Catskill.net, I'm Dave DeGraw, and you're listening to Interrobang. Before we dive in, I just wanted to let you know, if you're listening on a podcasting app, there is a video part of this podcast available on YouTube, as well as if you're watching on YouTube, you can also subscribe and follow the show on Apple Podcasts or any other podcasting app. Check out Tom's blog at macwrite.com. I'll have links to all of his stuff in the show notes. Let's get right into it. Tom, thanks for joining me today, man.
Thank you. Yeah, it's great to be here.
Awesome. Well, hey, here's the first thing I want to ask you about, okay? And your recent, one thing I like about Tom's blog, your blog, is that you just do recently blog posts. So you just have a bunch of blog posts that are titled recently, and it's just kind of a recap of what you've done recently. And I think that that's really cool. I don't know that I've ever seen anybody else do that. But in your recently blog post, you talk about e-mobility and e-bikes. And I am like very interested to hear more of your thoughts on, because you say I could probably write a whole blog post about e-bikes and e-mobility. And this is something I think about like a lot. Like I live in a retirement community and those e-bikes are very popular with like senior citizens and stuff. And I interact with kind of people on e-bikes. So I'm curious to hear what your thoughts on that are.
Yeah, I live in Brooklyn. And that's kind of relevant because I think it's kind of the only American city with the very particular kind of delivery bikes that we have here, which are essentially, they're kind of mopeds at this point. They're throttle e-bikes and they can go very fast and they tend to explode pretty often.
Well, are you saying like 40 mph or what's very fast, like 40 miles an hour or faster? 20,
30,
35. Fast enough that if you crashed one, you could very likely get seriously injured or maybe die.
Yeah, and people get into grisly accidents all the time. The accidents between delivery riders are really gnarly. And it's like kind of a paradoxical, really tough political question of what to do with this, because the delivery cyclists in this city are like mostly undocumented, like mostly Latin American and African immigrants. And it's like increasing policing of these people is just kind of the last thing that I want to, or anyone wants to do. Like that's awful, especially in today's political climate.
Totally.
But they also are just like a terror on the streets. And, like accidents actually do happen. And that has really motivated the city to clamp down on e-biking in general. So now there is a 15 mile per hour speed limit that the city thinks it can enforce, which I think it may actually be able to enforce on all e-bikes, which also feels like a total overreaction because we're also criminalizing a lot of stuff about cycling as well. Like if you roll through a stoplight on a bike right now, the police can actually put points on your driver's license and issue a ticket where you have to go to court to argue it.
You're talking on a pedal bike.
On any kind of bike. Wow. Yeah. So it's really, it's wild. So that's kind of the situation in the city. And then I've been kind of seeing how e-bikes play out outside of the city and how people treat them. I don't know. Like, I guess my kind of the way that I think about a lot of technology is that like a lot of technology is a force multiplier. And once you get to like a really high multiplication factor, things get scary. Like one of the lovely things about cycling is that to go really fast, you either need to be really strong or really brave, like going downhill. And like knowing that you're doing something stupid.
Yes.
Like when you're on a lightweight road bike going 40, 50 miles downhill, you are terrified.
Yes.
And that's kind of good. And then I see these things where it's like, here's a way to give something like that experience automatically to anyone. And people don't have to exert enough effort or feel enough fear in that situation. And it just feels like it turns cycling into kind of the same thing as driving, where like all you have to do is like push your right foot down and you can kill some people. You know, that's kind of bad, in my opinion.
It's interesting because, okay, I live in the suburbs, right? And, like, America, in my opinion, has a transportation problem. Like, if I was the president of the United States, I would be, like, so focused on transportation because, like, cars, like, it's amazing to me that Americans and human beings in general operate vehicles as safely as we do, knowing, like, what the failure mode is of crashing is, like, devastating, right? Like, even a minor fender bender can give you lifelong pain. We don't have public transportation, so it's basically you're on your own for a car. It's expensive, it's inconvenient. I think about the single mom racing across town to pick her kid up from daycare before they close after doing a 12-hour Amazon warehouse shift, and then, like, plows through runs a red light, and man, like, I see it all the time. I really do here. It makes me really sad. So on that token, it's like new forms of mobility, e-mobility, e-scooters, e-bikes, things like that. It's like, yeah, I really like the idea that, like, you know, realistically you could have a job in the suburbs and get around and be okay with an e-bike, with a, you know, $500, $1,000 e-bike. But on the other hand, it's like you say, it's a new risk factor and people underestimate it, man. Like, yeah, even just knowing the physics of, like, impact and force, like going from 10 miles an hour to 15 miles an hour to 20 miles an hour, it's not like, oh, 2x more damaging. It's like multiple, right? Like exponentially more harmful if you crash. And so it's like, oh yeah, you know, I'm like, normally I do 15 on my bike and now I'm doing 25. It's like, that's actually a huge deal. And especially when you get people, you know, you don't need any licensure or even, like, it's just totally open field out here, at least. I'll see people cruising down the sidewalk on e-bikes when I'm, you know, pulling out into traffic. And it's like, I mean, now I look to see if there's people coming on either directions on the sidewalk. And certainly they say, oh, well, you know, bicycling was always the same way, but as ubiquitous and as the adoption rises. Yeah, I think about it a lot for sure.
Yeah, I think that one... The video that I saw was Berm Peak, who reviews a bunch of bikes. Yeah. And I think the craziest part was just that these bike companies have been self-regulating, essentially, where there are all these classes for e-bikes and some of them are super fast. And then the bike companies just ship you a bike, which can be like a class 3 bike. And then they ship you a sticker and you have to, like, choose which class the bike is going to be and then make sure you follow the laws of whichever jurisdiction you're in. And that just feels like, you know, there should probably be a little bit more of a heavy-handed regulations that, you know, a kid can't buy a bike that's just a motorcycle.
Well, in my optimistic take is, at least here in the suburbs, I hope that we transform our roadways back into pedestrian focused with bicycle lanes, right? Like, I mean, you've been to Europe recently and seen kind of the term I like to use is vehicular cycling. There's a Wikipedia article on vehicular cycling that you can go look up. It's really interesting. Vehicular cycling. Like, I mean, and you talk about, like, public health benefits too, like just having to exercise, even if it's only a little bit, to go out and, you know, socialize. I think those are all good things. So, you know, yeah, it's interesting because it's like growing pains. I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic that we can overcome it and find solutions. But right now, it does feel scary. It does feel like you walk out your front door on the sidewalk and get taken out by some dude on a bird scooter, maybe intoxicated. And, like, seriously, like a head injury at age 40 or whatever, lifelong. Like, yeah, I think about it a lot.
Yeah. And these are things that people fought for, like, for decades. There's been so much activism for the bike lanes, and it just feels... It feels bad to have them be a place where there's, I guess, bad behavior. I don't know. I don't know how to phrase it. Just like a different kind of conflict than the conflict that I expected.
Well, and now too, that it's like, I guess it's just kind of inherent to capitalism, but it's like, look, dude, if you can pay a dude on an e-bike, to deliver your burritos for you or whatever it is. That's like we the consumer saves more, the business saves more, like it's easier, more convenient. But on the other hand, if, I don't know, hospitalization rates, like that's a public it's a tax on the public, like our infrastructure and things like that. So yeah, man, it's the okay, here's my personal pet peeve, honestly kind of the reason why I'm talking about it. I go on a walking trail, dude. Like the area I'm in Southern Utah, we've got like a pretty good extensive biking and walking, like they're separate from the roads. I like to go on walks, and there's signs everywhere that say no motorized vehicles, but yet e-bikes are fine. And I literally I'll like, if you know somebody's riding an e-bike past me, I'll be like, oh hey, does it have a motor in it, you know, like just kind of facetiously, because I honestly don't get it. Like, and maybe it's just because it's not gas. Like a motorcycle, you rev it up and you can hear it and you can feel it, but man, 30 miles an hour is 30 miles an hour regardless of what's powering that, in my opinion. Like
yeah. And I mean, I'm a bike sicko. I'm about to go on a 340-mile ride in 4 days.
Cool.
On a very non-electric bicycle, of course. Cool. So like the whole idea of like pedaling is very appealing to me. And I just don't totally understand the idea of like making that faster. I guess like bikes are pretty fast. You're doing them as enjoyment.
Yes.
Like, do we have to?
Yes.
It's almost like bringing optimization culture to something that's a hobby.
Yes. That's what I don't understand, dude. Because it's like, bro, if you want to go ride a bike, ride a bike. Like, and if you can only ride 200 feet or whatever it is, ride your bike up and down your street 3 times. And like, that's your exercise, right? But why do you have to go like 10 mile? Like, you're not, I don't know, if you're not like commuting to work, you're not delivering burritos, you're not trying to go fast. And it's just, again, it's like bringing an optimization to a problem. I don't know, that doesn't even exist. And if it does, it doesn't need optimization, because dude, like I just feel like if you want to go cruise 40 miles an hour down the street on an e-bike, just go get a car. Like you'll be way safer, like way safer. Very cool. So you're big into cycling. I noticed you did work with the DC bike, the DC, whatever, I wrote it down, the DC code on lines, but specifically because you're interested in the cycling bylaws. And so is what you're describing with the multiple 100-mile bike tour, what's the term for that? Is it touring or what do you call it?
It's called bike packing. I think that's kind of a newish term, but it's, you bring all the backpacking stuff on a bike. And so we'll, camp for 2 nights.
So, awesome.
Yeah, I'm very excited for it, and hopefully, you know, my body is able to do it. We'll see.
So it's kind of, okay. So where are you going to be going then? Is it going to be here in the States?
Yeah, there's essentially fully car-free trails all the way from Pittsburgh to Washington, D.C. So we're driving to Pittsburgh, riding through Cumberland, Maryland, and then to D.C., and then the train back up here.
Oh, nice.
And it's all former railroads, the CNO, the Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad, and the Great Appalachian Passage, which I think was some other railroad. The collapse of the railroads gave us some nice bike trails that are also extremely flat, and is my, you know, once a decade or every decade opportunity to spend a little bit of time in West Virginia. Oh, yeah, and, you know, the real the real woods.
I spent quite a bit of time in Eastern Kentucky in the Appalachians. So like I vibe with that area hard for sure. It's unique and interesting for sure. But, that's really cool, man. What do you feel like the experience is like doing it multiple days? You know, you ride, you're you ride all day. You ride what? 12 hours?
Yeah, pretty much. Hopefully 10,
10 we'll hours, see. Having lunch, you know, boiling water, eating out of a backpack. You pitch your tent, go to sleep, and then wake up the next morning and do it again. What, kind of like walk me through, I don't want to say the appeal of that, because that kind of sounds like I'm implying that it wouldn't be appealing, but you specifically, like what fires you up about that?
I think that maybe there's that apocryphal Ronald Reagan quote, I think, of once you've seen one tree, you've seen them all, which I always found silly. And I like would joke about my, you know, and whenever people wanted to go to camp in California, I was like, oh, come on. But there's, I feel like once you've seen like thousands of trees, there's like this aggregate experience of nature, which is that where you're like, you're 7 hours in and you've just been riding through a forest with the trees swishing past you the whole time. And that I feel like is when I really start to like notice birds and see the sun in a different way, like really, you know, get really accustomed to being in nature. And the tiredness also helps a little bit with it. It's really close to like a zen-like state that you can get into if you're having a good time. Because I, you know, also relative to ordinary life, it's just you're spending your entire day and the thing that you're doing is so incredibly clear and straightforward. Yes. It's right in front of you. You know, you're just doing that.
I don't know. I can keep like, it's like, man, I'm freaking tired and I'm kind of hot, but you keep pedaling, right? But in city life and normal life, it's like, what am I even doing, man? And honestly, a lot of times, like the answer isn't even necessarily clear or will ever be clear. It's like sometimes the answer is just like, you know what we're doing, man? We're participating in a society by your choice, you know? And I'm not saying that that's bad, but I can totally see what you're saying with the appeal of like, yeah, man, like I can wake up and pedal, or I can lay here for an extra 20 minutes. And tonight when I'm setting up my tent, it'll be darker and, you know, I'm trying to cook my food and it's going to be dark and harder. And I don't know. It just makes you feel like, yeah, man, I'm like, it's empowering, I guess, maybe is what I feel like. Would that be a fair word?
Yeah. Yeah. It makes you really aware of like both what you're capable of and what you did. There's nothing like the hunger of being like actually hungry because you've actually, you know, ran out all of your internal fuel tanks. Yes. You know, your ATP is gone.
I think that that's cool too, because I think when you're able to view like sustenance, like food, like I'll get to the point where it's like raw calories, right? It's like, it really is like it's kilowatt hours. It's energy, right? And you're like, okay, look, dude, I need to like dump in enough fuel because I know how much I'm going to need. And yeah, it's maybe you tap into some of the reserves. I don't know. You look like a pretty thin guy, but everyone, you know, got a little bit flab under the skin or something, but you tap into that and it feels good for sure. Very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm excited for it. I would recommend it to anyone who wants to do it. Especially this trail. There are no bears, you know, no natural predators. There's water on the side mostly. So cool. It's good.
So you just filter it and drink it, or do you have to pack your own? Because I know that's a big weight thing, right? Is water.
Yeah. The pumps on the side of the trail, they have little iodine in them, which cleans the water and also makes it taste terrible. So if that's a problem, it's a problem. But otherwise, yeah, it's great.
Nice. So what advice would you give to somebody who, let's say it's like, most of my life I've been like pretty unhealthy and like, I've never really done a lot of like physical activities, or I'm just not used to doing that. So I went out and bought an e-bike and I think it's like totally awesome, but it's like, now I'm starting to ask myself some of these same questions of like, what's the point of riding the e-bike? Like, should I just get a normal bike? So for somebody like that, maybe somebody like me, what would you recommend to them as a way to get into cycling, and specifically, I can't remember the term you use for it, but specifically what you're doing, like what's the best way to start?
It's hard to say because like all the things that I've been doing since the beginning of time. But for a lot of cities, they have, for here we have transportation alternatives, but basically every city has its own little bike lobby. And like, I'm sure that like Salt Lake City has its own, like its crew. And they usually do like group rides and they're super welcoming and like diverse and nice and all that stuff. So at least in the city, that's like where I see a lot of people starting to get going. And I think it's great because like a lot of it is cultural. A lot of it is like habits and how you're supposed to kind of behave, your manners. And you can pick that up really quickly if you're with a big crowd of people.
Very cool. Yeah. I'm just trying to think because at one point I lived in Lexington, Kentucky, which is kind of like, it's like a smaller city, but it's a city. It's kind of suburban, spread out. But my primary, like the only mode of transportation I had that I used was a pedal bike. I'd ride everywhere and I'd use the bike lanes. And one thing that I really liked about it is and I think this can be true no matter where you are, because the fastest way to get somebody in a car I can't remember the smart way to say this, but basically the fastest way to get from point A to point B is rarely the most direct, right? In fact, most of the time it's not the most direct. It's like, oh, we're going to go out of this way so we can get on the interstate, and then we're going to go 90 miles an hour. Like, but on a bike,
yeah,
that point A to point B line maybe is still not optimal, but man, you can cut through a residential neighborhood. Oh, and this connects to this park that has a trail that I can cut through. And like, it's just such a better way to see the world. And part of me, that's why when I see people just riding their bikes on the sidewalk along the major roads in the suburban area that I live in, I'm like, man, you're doing it wrong. Like, not only is it dangerous, but you're missing out on so much more that you could see. Like, take the back street, take the other way. It's just as fast on a bike. In fact, probably faster, because then you're not dealing with as much traffic, right? I think that really gets me fired up and makes me want to cycle more.
Yeah, probably safer too. You don't want, like, the back roads are usually a little bit safer.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, because what's like the biggest hazard of cycling? Like getting hit by a car, crashing?
What? Yeah, it's always cars.
Cars?
Yeah, it's always cars.
Dude. Yeah. They're so dangerous. It's and that's what I mean. It's like, it's wild to me that like a lot of people do get very injured and hurt by vehicles, in vehicles, driving vehicles. But it's surprising to me that honestly, it's like when they say like faith in humanity restored, it's like the fact like they're so complicated and difficult machines to operate and, you know, mechanically drive and do it safely. It's a big testament to our ability to actually do hard things. I just wish maybe we could sometimes take a little bit more time to examine, you know, is the hard thing we're doing worth doing, or is there an easier way that may be more worthwhile?
Yeah.
I like on your blog, you talk about, and this is probably in relation, on Macedon, you were talking about this just yesterday or the day before, you had made a DIY bike pack bag. So you sewed it up together, and then you were talking on Macedon about some improvements, and I think you maybe made a V2 or a different, slightly different bag. So talk me through about your DIY bag making, man. Like, that's, I've never heard anyone doing that. That seems really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a really fun way to get into sewing. Because kind of like the hard part of sewing, as far as I understand it, or there are like two things that are hard. Like, one is measuring stuff, which is kind of the hard part of most hobbies. And then the other thing is that fabric is stretchy. So like if you're, if you know origami, if you know how to like do things in CAD or whatever, you can do all those things and then the fabric stretches and it's kind of meaningless because it's not a solid surface. But bags, not really stretchy. So at least they're like a nice entry point where you can measure something and it will stay that size. So it started off, I got a ridiculous bicycle that's kind of weirdly shaped, and it doesn't really fit any stock bags. And I guess one of my friends had made one, and I got peer pressured into doing it. My mom helped me out a ton. So I made the first one with her guidance. It was like a maybe 8-hour project, which is just super fun. And now, yeah, I got like a 1968 sewing machine from a nice woman in the Upper West Side, and it's working great. I've made like 6 bags now, I guess, with it. We'll see. It's a little bit insane. Like, I made this one yesterday or the day before, and I'm just going to use it on this trip and hope for the best. So we'll see if it all falls apart. That'll be the first time that this has gone wrong. But it's fun. Like, there are so many different ways to do it. This is one of the things that the internet does so well, is like people sharing sewing tips. The number of YouTube channels from like 60-year-old women that have helped me through with this, it's incredible. Thank you to all of those people.
Yep.
And yeah, there's like an old guy who records YouTube videos of fixing and threading the exact machine that I have as he grumbles along. It's great. It's like, yeah, the lighting's always bad, but it's always really helpful, really nice. Sewing's amazing.
What would you say is like, I don't have any frame of reference. I guess I wonder, like, how good are commercial bags. Like if I go into a bike store and buy like say the equivalent of what you made, like quality wise and then also like price wise, like is there just like I assume that there's a ton of markup on that kind of stuff. So I mean, and obviously when you're making your own bags, you got to go buy like, you know, have waste and you have leftover fabric and stuff like that, but at the same time you have leftover fabric, so like if you want to make a fanny pack or something, it's like that's an option, you know. So I'm kind of curious, like what's your impression on the quality of the manufactured goods versus when you can DIY it?
The quality of almost all of our like manufactured fabric goods is way better than we deserve, is my takeaway. Like going through this whole process has made me look at like my backpack, which I guess is like a fancy backpack relatively, but like, you know, it was like $120 or something like that. And just thinking about how hard it would be for me to recreate this, I'm just like, it would take me 3 months of learning to get anywhere close to this quality. And like looking at, you know, my cheap t-shirts or whatever, the level of like craftsmanship that we have available to us is crazy. It makes me feel so bad about like throwing stuff away now. Cause like, I just, once you see like bags with tons of zippers and all of the seams are fully closed, like all that stuff is really hard. The level of quality that I'm at is approaching the absolutely lowest level of quality of something that you could buy, I would say.
But it's completely custom though, right? Which is,
oh yeah, it's totally worth it. I'm not doing it because it's better. I'm doing it because like it's a skill and it's fun and it's custom, and you know, I can make bags that are the same weird yellow color that I want them to be.
Yeah, it's, I guess I don't know. I've been kind of fascinated because I learned about like US clothing sizes, small, medium, large, extra large. And those did not exist until the Civil War. Like, because during the Civil War, they had so many people that needed uniforms. Before that, they were all tailor-made, custom-made. But like, I looked for the number. I'm going to quote it again out of thin air, but something like those only fit like 25% of people, like those standard clothing sizes, right? So something about like, I don't know, because I think a lot about waste and I to buy 10 ill-fitting t-shirts versus like two really good fitting t-shirts that are high quality and custom or whatever, I can see the benefit. Like there's pros and cons. I think it's probably the same argument that we're having over e-bikes. It's like, you know, technology moves us forward, but it's worthwhile to step back and analyze what direction are we moving in. Is this, you know, like the logical conclusion is we're going to make the cheapest, most effective bag ever. But then again, you have a custom weird bike that you made a custom bag for that's one of a kind. And I don't know, there's something very worthwhile about that, isn't there? Not in addition to the learning process.
Yeah. Going halfway, I think, makes a lot of sense. You know, learning how to hem your clothes is probably the perfect midpoint for most people. It's like making a t-shirt from scratch is crazy.
Yeah.
Just making like the t-shirt that I'm wearing would require a totally different machine than the one that I have. Like it would require probably 2 months of learning. But like, yeah, adjusting the size of this one, that I could knock that out in an afternoon.
That's cool.
And it's good that people have cheap t-shirts. Like, you know,
People are more clothed. There's not a lot of kids running around in America with no shoes or socks on anymore. You know, like that.
Yeah,
that
exactly. Big
thing. Yeah. There are people freezing to death and things like that. So that's cool. And it's funny because you talk about on like YouTube videos of like random old ladies that teach you how to do stuff. I DIY'd this. I learned how to screen print my own t-shirts. And nice. the person I learned how to do it from was this lady on YouTube with like, you know, like 2,000 subscribers or whatever. And it's like her technique is exactly what I use because I want to do it small scale and kind of, I don't want to like pay somebody to make 100 t-shirts because I just feel weird about that. But I think that is a really cool thing about the internet is the freedom and sharing of information, right? It's like those ideas, they can just make our lives better. But on the other hand, there's a lot of, I don't want to say incorrect ideas, but look, media is who we become, and they're constantly trying to influence us via the media that we consume, right? Like, even just like small, like subtle things. Like I was playing Return to Castle Wolfenstein. It's like this old 2000s PC game. And it's like, there's these like sexy Nazi, like femme, like kind of lesbian chicks. And it's like, do we really want to like teach kids about like sexy Nazi? Like, is that like from a, like from, you know what I mean? Like, is that like problematic? And you know, who's making that decision? I guess I just think a lot about the media and kind of the decisions that were made behind the media that I consume. Do you have any thoughts about, I don't know, do you feel that way? Cause you're into kind of, I don't want to say alternative media, but you're into like open media, like Mastodon and open platforms and blogging on your own thing. It's not like at the bottom of your blog, there's like an ad for Home Depot, right? Like, so I was kind of curious what your thoughts on that were.
Yeah, I feel like I've really done a lot of work to insulate myself from feeds, I guess.
Yes.
Mastodon is great because you follow who you follow.
Yeah, can I put an asterisk there and say algorithm-based feeds? Algorithmically generated feeds, yeah.
Yeah. And then every time that I get anywhere close to them, we're like, you know, if I'm looking at YouTube and it just starts auto recommending stuff, it really feels like you're going outside and the environment's been polluted and you're like, oh, this is what the rest of the world is like. It's like terrible outside of the bubble. Like I just want to stay in this tiny little filter bubble that I've constructed for myself. And it's just, yeah, I don't know. Like now, yeah, I guess new content increasingly just feels, I just feel like I can see what they're doing too much, I guess. I'm talking about TikTok, which I try to keep deleted from my phone, but occasionally it just creeps back on there when I'm feeling spiritually weak. but it's just like, you can really see people seeing the algorithm and the algorithm seeing them, and everything that they're doing kind of has this layer of like optimization and customization, like on the human side, they're catering to the algorithm, and that just feels so dehumanizing at like a really core level, where you're just like, oh, TikTok really needs me to say something in the first like 2 seconds of this video, and so I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna add these tags that are gonna bump it up in the algorithm. It just feels like it's making things better for a theoretical person and worse for the actual person who's going to consume the content.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, cause it's like on one hand, right, it's like, we've got like the Rupert Murdochs of the world. I don't want to get assassinated here for name dropping, but like, like you have the Rupert Murdochs of the world, like objectively making decisions about the media that we consume and kind of what we're allowed to see and how we see it and things like that. Right. Now we're in 2025. We have algorithms that are opaque to the users. They're probably opaque to the people who develop the algorithms. Like, I don't think any one YouTube engineer could tell me why a video is getting recommended to me or why not, right? Like, the answer would be complicated if they could. But then that is our feedback loop, dude. Like, it's exactly like a rat in a cage receiving electrical shocks randomly, and they're able to train. Like, they're like, it's scary, dude. Like, and I think about this because there's a YouTube channel, Jeff Geerling. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He has some pretty good videos. Yeah. He had a blog. He wrote a blog post. I follow him on Mastodon, by the way. And he blogged recently about YouTube views are down across the board, right? Like for all the channels, all big channels, like YouTube views are just way down. And the thing that I think a lot about, dude, I think about Linus Tech Tips, LTT. Because he has 50 plus, 100 plus employees, writers, editors, people working on his videos, people doing brand integrations, everything you can think of, selling merch. And I think about it in terms of like, if I was a writer for LTT, like, I guess I think about it in terms of incentive structures. Am I incentivized to make an objectively good video, or am I incentivized to get a lot of views on a video? And if I'm incentivized to get a lot of views on a video, what's the easiest way? What's the most pain-free, cheapest way that I could get views on a video? Could I buy a content form to just watch the video that I made for LTT.com? And, you know, so my boss thinks it was successful and we're happy. But it's like an unsustainable, like, because it's opaque, right? Like, we don't know what is actually going into that. that was a long tangent. I guess I was kind of curious, like, do you have any thoughts on that for me? Because this is a problem that I really struggle with.
I wrote a thing like not a long time ago, probably a year and a half ago. I don't know. Which was just like all incentive systems are bad.
Yes.
It's kind of my view on the world. And one of the reasons why I've always been like, oh, my, you know, the blog is not something that makes money. Is because I feel like as soon as I attach an incentive system to anything that I do in my life, it corrupts it.
Yes.
And the things that like the incentive systems that work are like organic and incredibly hard to game and intrinsic. And then everything else just like blows up in everyone's faces. I think like ironically, Google was like the one incentive system which I thought was good for maybe it's decreasingly, but maybe for 2019 to 2023 or something like that. Like SEO was pretty cool because it was really hard to game. And so Google was just like, you just have to make a good website and none of the hacks work. And we try to make none of the hacks work. And like, that was kind of interesting because like, I didn't do anything to optimize SEO and my website has pretty decent SEO, even though I didn't like stick meta keywords or anything like that into it. But I think that's going away now, obviously. But like, I think for all of these channels, it's like, I don't know, for TikToks especially, the incentive system is just so immediate and clear and gameable and then also kind of arbitrary that it just drives the creators insane. It drives the people watching the content insane.
Like even something as simple as negativity bias, right? In the headlines in the article that I had that went to the front page of Hacker News, I would say the headline was negatively biased. It was titled "What the Hell Is Going On?" Right? and it's interesting that I literally have blog posts titled like "You Can Make a Difference," like "Where Do You Want to Go Today?" Trying to be as positive and uplifting as I can. And the one time, man, I was like a Friday night and I had just quit my job and I was pissed off about LLMs and worried about what they're actually doing to the world. It's like, that's the thing that people pay attention to, man. And even something as simple as that is kind of terrifying.
Yeah, it's really sad. I don't know. Maybe the counterweight is that like it feels like the more time that I spend on trying to actively engage and seek out and like collect the manicured customized feed of everything, the better the world seems. And a lot of the hyper algorithmic feeds are for the people who are the extreme marginal consumers of Twitter, where you know you log in and you never follow anyone and you just like drink from the fire hose.
Hell, dude, it would be hell. Like you would be meant to, don't know, dude, like how could you? It's no wonder. It's terrifying. I'm actually like, I mean, I don't want to sound like a crazy conspiracy theorist, but like, look, we know that Russia influenced the 2016 election and continues to do so. Like, we know that they're actually really like North Korea and like adversaries of the United States are pretty freaking good at cyber warfare. And that includes propaganda online. Right. And like even something so it's like, I don't know. Like I literally look at something and it's like, do you think a Russian troll farm posted this to Reddit? Like, what do you think what do they want me to believe? But when I can follow, when I can subscribe to Tom Mackwright's RSS feed, man, and you drop a recently blog post, it's like, it's pure. Like it's the antidote to that problem. And the thing I want people to know is that you can do it, man. Like it's not even that hard. And he doesn't even have to be great either. So literally do whatever you need to do. Like start. Okay, it needs to be an open platform, which owning your own domain name and your blog stack, no matter where you keep it or whatever it is, that's great. It doesn't have to be there. You know, I'd encourage you not to go to Medium because, like, don't go to these closed platforms where somebody's making money and incentivized to having you post. But I mean, I think the simplest way for me is like literally just like text your friends, like call up your friend, like unplug from the algorithm and just engage genuinely. Like, we can trust each other. I can trust that when I'm talking to you on a call, it's like, you're not getting paid to be here. And I'm like, I don't have any sponsors, like, relatively speaking, you know, compared to million view YouTube channels, like, I, there's no audience here. But that's the thing that fires me up is the audience is you. And I don't mean you, I mean you, but like the person listening to this, right? It's like, I literally, like, if one person listens to this podcast and thinks it's cool, like, mission accomplished, dude, like 100% for real.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like self-selecting, definitely the people who have blogs and write. But it doesn't have to be gigantic. It doesn't have to be popular. I don't know. A lot of people who I follow, like I am probably one of 10 people following their blogs or whatever. And like, I don't know them, but they write good stuff. You know, all, like there's value in it. I think, I don't know. There's intrinsic value that's really hard to measure, which is the best kind in my opinion.
Yeah. It seems like, you know, the, I don't know if you heard the quote, but like, once the metric becomes the goal, it no longer is a good metric. Because like views is a good metric. Like I look at my page views per month and it's like a good metric. Like I can see, I don't know, trends and what people are looking at, but it's like, that doesn't tell me like anything. All the only thing that tells me is like, theoretically this many people are doing this, but like that, like, I don't even know if they like it. Like maybe people are like rage, like, you know, maybe my blog is like rage bait and people like look at it and there's some Discord server where like people are talking about how terrible of a person I am. I mean, I would hope not, but I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, I really don't know. So if I keep like, oh, I'm going to like keep posting articles, like what the hell is going on? Like what the hell is up with e-bikes? You know what I mean? Like I can keep doing that, but it's like, that's a bad feedback loop, man. It's a scary feedback loop.
Yeah. I don't have any analytics anymore, which is why I haven't noticed some of the more insane places that my writing has ended up. I think there's who's the guy with the mustache, I think? There's like a YouTube tech guy who's kind of famous. Oh,
the Primeagain. The Primeagain? Is that who you're talking about?
Yeah, the Primeagain. Yeah. I think he did a video about a pull request that I made a while ago where like I maintain a statistics module. And there was a bug, a very subtle bug that survived for like quite a long time, an embarrassing amount of time. And somebody like reported it and I fixed it in a PR and he just like had a little segment about how like my response and stuff. It was nice, but it was also just, it was nice because he was humanizing and like, oh, these kinds of mistakes can happen because you have these conditions and it only pops up in this very narrow case. But like, it was just funny to see like my very niche thing that I expected nobody to see, and then like a line of people commenting on it on the right in real time as some internet personality talks about it.
Yeah, man, I guess I'm sitting here thinking about this. So you used to have analytics on your blog and you removed them?
Yeah, I forget when, maybe like 5 years ago.
You just felt like, what, like, I guess, again, I'm not like, I'm just interested in hearing like about that. I'm not like trying to like, you should or you shouldn't have analytics. I have analytics. So it's not like, whatever, but.
It was more for like, they weren't doing anything for me positively, I think. And, I like the blog to be like hyper minimalistic too. Like there's no JavaScript.
Yeah.
It's very lightweight. Yeah, and right around that time too, like I got a lot of things on Hacker News and kept like reading the comments and getting in like a bad mental place with that. And it's just, you know, I wanted to quit that cycle and I did. It's nice.
You know, it's interesting. I recently watched Malcolm X with Denzel Washington. Great movie. Really like fascinating. There's a scene in the movie where his wife is at home and they're receiving like threatening phone calls. Like the phone is ringing off the hook, like at all hours of the night. Right. And she's like so stressed about it. And it's like, I mean, that is awful. That's like an awful thing. And people go through that. Right. But I sit here and I think it's like, what if you just unplugged the phone? Like then you wouldn't even know if people are calling. Right. Like, why? And it kind of like, I guess I can kind of see, because I see myself doing that. It's like, they shared my blog post on this random website and I go and look and it has 30 comments and people are making fun of me. And like, yeah, is that helpful? Or should, and I think about it too. It's like, if you walk down the street, if you like knew definitively how many people thought your outfit was cool that day, is that good or bad? Like, we don't know, right? Which is why when somebody says like, hey man, cool shirt, it means a lot, right? Like, it's like, oh yeah, you and 17 other people thought that, like, you know what I mean? It's just more genuine. I feel like, I think that's really cool. Yeah. That you removed your analytics.
Yeah. And I have, in response to like blog posts and everything, I've like met and heard great, interesting viewpoints, but most of those were people who wrote blog posts in response, or, you know, like most of those people are like actively doing a thing. I don't think that it's really been such a thing that like a Hacker News comment has added to the conversation a ton, I guess. It's interesting. I just like don't want that. I don't want too many things that are charts of whether my life is going well or not. Like, I feel like I have enough.
You also have, forgive me if I'm wrong here, and I'm going out on a tangent, but I feel like you had a blog post that referenced the quantified self.
Oh yeah. I used to be pretty hardcore into it.
Really? As well. Really?
Yeah.
So I guess like, cause like, like you could describe a, you could describe that as like Google Analytics for your personal life, right? Like quantified self, right? A while ago I went through this like hardcore, I don't know, mental phase where I was obsessed with the concept of data weaponization. You work for a company that has key card badges on the doors, and they literally will weaponize that data against you, for or against you, right? They can say, well, look, Dave's here at 6:45 every morning, we should give him a promotion. Capitalism doesn't really work that way. More than likely, they're going to say, dude, like, this guy doesn't badge in or whatever it is. And you want to know what the answer is? It's like, somebody let me in, right? Or whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, we have all these analytics that just like feed us garbage that we interpret incorrectly to mean things that absolutely don't matter. On the other hand, we have the quantified self movement. So I was kind of curious, like hearing that you're into that, or were into that, tell me more about that.
I mean, I still have, let's see, you know, I'm getting my heart rate continuously from my watch. And I learn a few things from that, I guess. You know, when you sleep less, your heart rate's higher. That's like the main thing. But early on, I made this thing called Minute, which is probably from 2013 or 2014 or something like that. And it was like a keylogger on my own computer that would return, that would record like the time that I had made every keystroke.
Wow.
In like a text file. And it was interesting because like that, I was working such hours that was like a pretty decent proxy for when I was sleeping at that point. Like, I could just see the gap between keystrokes, and it was like, oh, that's 7 hours. And like, I slept 7 hours that night. You know, yeah, my early 20s, a wild time. And, you know, I feel like I learned a few minor things because of that. Mostly you just like learn one mechanism for action. But, you know, like, I have a lot of air quality sensors in my apartment, and now I know, like, if I have a party, the CO2 is high. If I don't use the vent above the stove, the, you know, PM2.5 is going to be super high. If it rains, the humidity is going to be high. And partly this, I've just realized that I'm just like a really dumb guy, you know, like, why wasn't I using the stove hood for all that time? Like, that's a pretty obvious thing, but for some reason I haven't been. You know, like, most people can realize that these things happen. I don't know. Like, the quantified self stuff is interesting. I feel like it's hard to do over the whole span of your life. And I want to be like really picky with like what metrics I do quantify, if anything. Like, I want everything to be kind of like a trailing metric, you know? So like, I read a bunch of books, but I don't aim for a number ever. Like, that's not something that I think about. But on average, I read like 23 books a year or 22 books a year or something like that for the last like bunch of years. And I don't know why. Like, that's kind of just how it ends up. But if I started targeting that goal, it would feel bad.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's like, yeah, kind of a, what you want to measure yourself and you want to measure like success, but quantified self also is like really rough. You know, everyone goes through dark periods and it's just pretty heartbreaking to like look at your quantified life and everything and just be like, oh, I was like in a depressive hole for 3 months.
It's very interesting because it's like we kind of go back to the analytics. It's like they'll tell us whatever story we basically want to hear, like, or we can construe them to mean. It's very hard to look at analytical data objectively. You have to be almost subjectively. We interpret it. And so you're kind of saying like, look, we all go through ups and downs. And it's like, man, when you're down, then that's just like one more nail in the coffin. Like, man, look at me 6 months ago. Look at my weight 6 months ago. Look at whatever it was 6 months ago. Look at me now. I am like objectively a piece of crap right now. Like my life is terrible right now. I'm sleeping worse than I've ever been. And knowing that isn't necessarily that helpful. Maybe it can be, but more retro, I guess it maybe feels like it needs to be more retrospective than more informative to the future. It's like, and it has to be over an adequate time scale as well. Like it can't be like day to day, or maybe there are metrics that can be day to day, but not really. I don't know. Like air quality. I'm huge on indoor air quality too. It's like nerds of a feather flock together, dude. Indoor air quality, CO2 specifically. I actually just taught Sunday school at my church yesterday, and I took my air quality sensor in. I brought it and just set it up at the front while I was doing it. And like, dude, the CO2 level, it's like, whew, like it's just going up and up and up. Like by the end of the lesson, it was like an hour, 45 minutes. It was like 2000 PPM, you know? And it's like, oh man, we got to open a window. We got to move here. Like there's cognitive effects of CO2. So I think it can be very informative, go ahead.
Oh, I also just learned something that I probably should have realized a long, long time ago. The amount of CO2 you produce is related to like your metabolism. And like I produce a lot more CO2 than my partner. Really? Like when she's in the room, the CO2 meter is way lower than it is when I'm in the room. Like I'm the problem in my household at least.
So the more you eat, the more CO2 you make. Is that kind of the thing?
Like the faster you're just burning calories, I guess, as like your basal metabolic rate, you're cycling through your oxygen and carbon dioxide.
Wow.
Can
being like, okay, I'm imagining like lung capacity, right? Like just how hard you have to breathe to get the air that your body needs. Like the healthier you get does that lower kind of those CO2 or not really?
I don't know. I think it might increase it. Really? Well, like, I guess if healthy means high metabolism, but maybe metabolism is fixed. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm looking at mine now. It's at 1086. I'm in my office with the door closed. So it's not great, but not terrible. Yeah. I mean, that's pretty okay. What is like the ambient CO2 level of where you're at there in Brooklyn?
The lowest it gets is 500 when I'm not in the room, I think. And when I'm in the room, it's usually 6-7 or higher.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's pretty good, dude.
Yeah, it's not bad. I live in a leafy neighborhood. So, you know, I think it depends on the plant, right? But that helps a little bit.
Helps a little bit. Well, and, you know, it's going back to the e-bike thing. It's like, well, you know, one thing e-bikes don't do, they don't pump out CO2 every time they drive past your house. That's for sure. Even if the guy's going 45 miles an hour and kills you on it, no CO2. Yeah. And honestly, it's a good thing. Even seeing the videos of like Shenzhen, China and things like that, where it's like they're pretty much all electric and it's just quiet again. It's like, it's just interesting, man. Technology, there's no silver bullet. It's a pendulum and there's pros and cons. But guess what, man? We're humans. We have smart brains most of the time. We're able to put them together. And I think we can come up with pretty good solutions to a lot of the problems. As long as we're being authentic. We're not interpreting data inaccurately. It's not that hard. Like, it can help, but Yeah, actually, you mentioned your reading log, which is one of my favorite parts about your blog, your reading log. And specifically, I was kind of curious because I was reading about how you make it. Can you just like, okay, so you export the data from Goodreads and then you convert it to YAML? Or how do you power your reading log? How do you do it? How do you do it?
I did it initially by exporting from Goodreads, but now I just don't use Goodreads at all. So it's probably, I don't know, it's not like fully automated. I copy the last post and then update the ISBN and the publisher and the publish date and the title and the front matter. And then I just write the blog post. It could be more automated, but like, I don't know, I can dig up 4 fields of data. It's doable.
So I'm a big like Jekyll nerd. We share that. Like I don't know. I love Jekyll. I think it's not perfect, but I really like it. So do you have a Jekyll collection then for your book reviews, or do you organize them differently?
Yeah.
So it's like,
yeah, everything's just a collection.
Cool.
I think I don't use I do use tags, I think, but I just like use one tag for each part of the site.
Okay.
I'm using like almost no Jekyll features, I guess. Like, it renders my blog
as it should.
I iterate through lists of things and render Markdown, and it works pretty well.
And then your blog, is that basically the same story, or do you have a more streamlined way to publish those?
I write those in Obsidian, and so that's like a subfolder of all my Obsidian notes. And then I have a little script that just like copies all of that folder from one folder to another on my computer and does an automated Git commit and pushes to Git and it goes live.
Heck yeah, man. Heck yeah.
Yeah. So it's nice and simple.
That's how it should be. For the people listening to this that are like, dude, should I start my own blog or should I do my own thing? It's like, yes, yes, you should. And it doesn't have to be super sophisticated and crazy. Do it the hard way. Do it the manual way. Like, it probably will make it more valuable that you did it, that it wasn't like this super slick 10-step automated thing where everything goes wrong all the time, you know?
Yeah.
Because one thing I do on my blog is I have a group of friends and we do a weekly playlist together. I need to get 3 picks from you before we, well, at some point I need to get 3 picks from you.
Yeah.
We've been doing this for a couple of years now and I started publishing them on my blog, and yeah, dude, I go into Apple Music and Apple Music will export a TSV. They don't tell you it's a TSV. They tell you it's just text, but it's a TSV, and Jekyll can actually ingest like CSV and TSV data directly. But then I have to go and I have a collection of playlists and I copy the old one and I put the links to the Spotify and Apple Music links and notate who put what songs on and everything like that. But, I don't know. I guess maybe there feels like there's something ritualistic about doing it that way. Like when you have this kind of manual process for your book reviews, it's like, yeah, there's a ritual to it. Like, it's like, oh, I finished the book. I'm going to like copy and paste the thing and fill it out and look up the ISBN and... there's a lot of value to that, I think.
It's like finishing a roll of film or anything. It's nice for life to have these like little sections. Like I use paper journals too, and it's really nice. The field notes are however many pages. There are exactly as many pages as I need to take a month of notes if I'm taking notes all the time. And then like you're done with your month's notes, you put a little date on the front of the thing and you put it in the cabinet. And it's really like an invaluable mental thing for me. I don't know. Like it really feels like you're externalizing your processing a little bit of things. You're just like accepting that the month is over.
Dude, I have so many questions I want to ask you about that. Okay. So you physically take notes on paper?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. And you use field notes?
Yeah.
What kind of pen do you use?
I mostly use the Mujis, 0.38s recently.
Ooh.
Sometimes 0.5s.
Heck yeah.
They're amazing pens.
Muji. Are they gel, ballpoint, or what are they?
I think they're gel.
Cool. Where do you get them from?
There are Muji. There's a Muji store in New York.
Cool.
But you can get them online, I think, now too.
JetPens.com, great website. Not affiliated, in case anybody looking.
Oh yeah,
JetPens is cool.
Yeah, I've used JetPens for other pens, and I tinker with other pens too. But cool. My heart returns to Muji. Muji
0.38, maybe 0.5. You go black ink,
yeah,
or blue ink.
I write with black ink, but I have like all the colors because my partner likes the colors.
Yeah. That's really cool. Yeah. I'll just kind of, since we're nerding out here a little bit, I'll show you. I've been using the Zebra G450, which is like a gel pen. I really like this thing lately, but then my friend for Christmas got me these Pilot Hi-Tech C Coletto is what it's called, multi-pen. And so I've got black, red, blue, and then here right now it's orange, but each month I actually, okay, because I want to dig into this, dude, because, okay, here's the other thing I do. I use 3.5 inch index cards for everything. So I designed, this is actually a website, or it's a blog post on my blog that I literally, every month I have to redeploy the blog, and then it'll automatically update the calendar, and then I can print that page out onto a 3.5x5 card. So every day I go through and I mark off the day, so you can see this month I'm using orange for some reason. I have blue for kind of personal things, and then black for things I'm less excited about. Yeah. Then on the back, I've got my, it's like a bullet journal, basically. So I have a daily ritual where I fill this out, and the system I have for note-taking is I just really like to-do lists on 3.5 inch cards. So I keep my to-do list. I date them every day, and it'll take me, you know, some months I'll go through 2 or 3 little cards there, front and back on both sides for my to-do list. But every month, man, like that ritual of redeploying the blog. It's October 1st now. Redeploy the blog, print out the thing, and then I collect my old note, my old to-do cards, and I collect my old journal and my calendar, and I have a little box in the closet that I can put them in. And sometimes I take a moment to reflect on previous months and see, I don't know, just like, what was I doing a year ago? And it's really, yeah, it's really great. Yeah. Physical notes. There's something about using a pen, I think is very worthwhile. I don't know what it is, but I was kind of curious. Yeah. Like, tell me more then about kind of your, what do you write down in your notebooks? What are you taking notes on? Just like, oh, I need to like shopping lists, or is it more, I sometimes feel like if I'm going to write it down in a notebook, it's like, I need it to be like good, like, I don't know, it can't be like throwaway, but I don't know, what's your philosophy?
Whoever discovers my notes and reads them once I'm gone, it's going to be so boring, it's going to be such a letdown, because like a lot of them are just very mundane, like here's what I did with these people, but they also really help with a lot of my notes are like kind of the CBT thing, I guess.
CBT,
it's like
cognitive behavior therapy.
Yeah, yeah. Where it's like, here's something that's going to happen, and here's how I feel about it.
Oh, that's cool.
And like what I think might happen, and then like it's an easy way to go back to that and just be like, oh, here's how it actually turned out. And I guess usually the answer is that, like, you know, your fears are usually unfounded, or everything's okay. And I'll use it to like unpack my feelings. I know I'm getting really touchy-feely here, but like, you know, I'll just be like, be nervous and list out, try to figure out why I'm nervous. And writing it down on a piece of paper is like very, it's very effective in my experience.
That's really cool, man. How long have you been practicing? I mean, it's probably kind of a thing that evolves over time, but.
Yeah, I think since 2015 or so, maybe since 2016, I've always been taking a little bit of notes. I had like a few, let's see. Yeah, I think like when things are really going down in life, it's useful to take notes. Like one time I was just like, oh, I need, you know, a record of what's happening here. And I like knew, actually the reason why I take notes all the time, or like the main inspiration, was a priest. Who I like worked with as a kid. He was like super great guy. I think Father Lash in New Jersey. And he was just like the most studious note taker I've ever met. He wrote everything down, and it was like really, it was really impressive. And that, yeah, sorry.
No.
To get really dark for a moment, that was very useful, because he was one of the people who testified against another priest for the, you know, priest, yeah, that thing that happened in the Catholic Church. And I was just like, oh, that's, you know, it's good to take notes, is my takeaway from that.
Yeah. I think, okay, this, maybe my brain works in weird ways. I love to hear about, religion, like religious studies is just like one of the things that I'm like personally just like way interested in. I'm pretty religious myself, but, I love learning about religion, like all kinds of religions, really. One of the coolest places I've ever been was the Baha'i House of Worship in Wilmette, Illinois, just outside of Chicago.
Oh, yeah.
If you ever have a chance to go there, it's just like awesome. Like, I don't even know, dude. It's just like awesome.
yeah.
But yeah, I was thinking, I was trying to figure out, I had this question, right? And it was like, why is Leonardo da Vinci so famous? Like, why him specifically? Like, he is so well known, especially among even the Renaissance scientists and artists. Like, Da Vinci is so well known. Maybe he has a kind of a bankable name. But one of the answers I came to, and this is true with him as well as other people, is habitual note-taking, methodical yeah. note-taking. Like, and again, we go back to leaving a legacy and genealogy and like, sometimes I think about like when I die, like, is there some person that's going to go through all these stupid to-do lists and my notebooks and like compile them? And like, I don't know, like, I guess it's like, for me, that sounds stupid and silly, but like, I don't want to make that assumption for them. Like, sure, if I die and my kids, even one person wants to go through my notes and find meaning there, I would like to provide them that opportunity. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's useful for probably unforeseen reasons, you know. I guess we don't know even what the most important parts of our lives are, just because you don't know what's going to happen. Yeah. And I also have a gigantic box of all my old notes that I almost never revisit. But it's nice to have them, I guess. I don't know.
You're Zettelkasten. Is that a term you're familiar with? Zettelkasten? You probably are. It's a German term
for yeah.
box of notes, I think. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's never the exact... technique has never worked for me, yeah. but like all German words, I enjoy it.
Yeah. Anything that I can appropriate, like any German term that I can appropriate to make myself look and sound cooler, I'll take.
Yeah.
Yeah. What other, did you have, I wanted to just make sure I let you finish whatever thoughts you were sharing when we cut out. Dude, I wrote down on my notes, drawings, fish trousers. I love the drawing you did of the fish. Do you know what I'm talking about? The fish in the fish pants guy?
Yeah.
I love that. I love that picture, man.
Oh, there's a story behind that. I don't know if I added it to the
I don't think thing. So. I didn't hear it. It's not ringing any bells, so why don't you tell me?
I was doing like a little club with some of my friends where we drew something every day for a month. And one of those nights, somebody mentioned they were talking about like a really problematic boyfriend that they had. And they were talking about like they asked the boyfriend, so if if you were dating a woman and it was going to be either half fish and it's either the top or the bottom, which one would you prefer? And they preferred the bottom, and or they preferred the top.
They yeah. want the top to be the fish,
top fish, yeah, bottom human, which I think everyone was like very alarmed at what this meant. But I think both combinations are really funny, kind of, you know, to draw, I guess, like a person with the fish pants, or, you know, a fish tail, or pants with a fish body. And pants with a fish body is like such an incredible thing to think about.
Because I'm sitting here thinking, it's like, okay, like,
you can't talk to them.
A person cannot have a lower torso. Like, that's still a viable person. But if you don't have an upper torso, yeah. you're like, that's not a viable person. However, say yeah. that like the fish was smart and had a brain, like the gills are on the top, I think. So maybe that implies this person can breathe underwater, which would be fascinating and interesting to think about. Maybe
yeah.
they say fish can't feel pain. So maybe, I don't know, that's controversial. I don't know if it is, but I'm not, but maybe that would have implications on your pain tolerance. So you just thought that was hilarious and decided to draw what that would look like.
Yeah. Yeah. It just seemed ridiculous. And it gives you a lot of leeway for how you want to style the fish and the pants, you know. I really want to draw things that you can't really tell whether they're like poorly drawn, because the thing that I'm drawing is confusing enough, I guess, that gives you a little bit of buffer.
So I was reading about your drawing and just kind of how you do it and everything. Like, I don't know, is there any philosophy behind that, or just kind of personal like motivation that you'd like to share?
So everyone else in my family is an artist. And I am the odd one out doing, like, you know, working in the tech industry. So yeah, it's been something that was always we did craft nights and drawing all the time, and everyone's happy birthday cards were always hand drawn in my family, even to this day. And it's just very intimidating. My mom will do hand drawn birthday cards that are just insane looking.
Like bizarre, or insane looking like she's really, really good at it.
She's just really, really good at it. Awesome. Yeah, like frighteningly good at it. And so, yeah, I think I inherited the enthusiasm for it, but maybe not the talent for it. And I just keep going forever. And I don't know. I feel like maybe at one point I'll try to learn how to draw better, but it's still fun to do it. And there's even at the level where I am, like I draw well enough to make myself happy.
Yeah. I think your drawings are excellent. And frankly, I'd push back on you saying that you're not very much of an artist either. Cause I think, well, here's the next topic, Teen Mom. I listened to the entire discography, I'll have you know. So if people want to check it out, it's teenmom.bandcamp.com, right?
Yeah, it is.
Cool.
Or Teen Mom.
Oh yeah. What is it?
Let me check, because we had Teen Mom DC in some places. Teenmom.bandcamp.com. Do we have? No, we're teenmomdc.bandcamp.com.
Teenmomdc.bandcamp.com.
Yeah.
I would describe it as 2010s era. it's, I don't want to kind of like indie jangle pop. Like there's definitely some like, I don't know, kind of like the Grizzly Bear, like Victimist kind of era, but that's like very reductive to even say that. Like, it's good, dude. It's like, it's got garage elements to it. It's got some like distortion. You guys got a couple songs that go harder. Teen Mom, very good. And honestly, all three of the albums are equally, in my opinion, like they're all great. Like it's not like, oh, they figured it out after the first one or anything like that. It's like they're all good. So what did you play in Teen Mom? What's your primary instrument?
I played bass.
Cool.
Guitar on one of the albums. I had always been like a guitarist and the lead singer of a previous band, but Teen Mom was just the three piece, so you know, I do what's necessary. And I had been playing with like that drummer since college. So we had just been like kind of the rhythm section of certain other bands. It was like, you know, 2/3 Tom and Sean, 1/3 whoever wanted to do a band.
Cool.
It was amazing.
I was trying to think, cause like it was, so you were based out of DC at that time, the band's based out of DC.
Yeah.
Like I'm trying to think like around that era, like, Future Islands, I think, are they DC based? I was trying to think, like, what was the scene like at that point?
Future Islands was Maryland.
Oh, sorry.
I think Future Islands and Beach House were both Maryland at that time. Out of our scene, almost nobody made it. Really? I would say, even though there were great bands, there were like fantastic bands around that time, and I still listen to a lot of our like DC label mates and stuff.
Will you drop, will you just drop a couple, can I go check them out? I'd love to.
Oh yeah. I mean, if you're looking for somewhere to start, like 10 Inch Astronaut, is an amazing, amazing band. The lead singer also played lead guitar as he's singing. It's all of the best parts of like DC math rock.
Cool.
Golden Looks, they're also really good. There are tons of great bands from that era. And it was like a very nice collaborative scene, kind of underdoggy, and plenty of like nice basements that everyone was playing in. Cool. Nice as in actually very grimy and kind of shitty, but like nice for everyone to be around.
And, yeah, welcoming, good environment. Yeah.
Yeah. And Brenda. Brenda, BRNDA. I think they go by now.
Cool.
But there's like a little bit of, if you've heard of Dismemberment Plan, I feel like they were like a DC band and also from the same college that I went to. And so a lot of DC musicians kind of followed in their footsteps. That particular flavor of like post-punk, math rock, there is a little bit of straight edge in there as well.
Because man, you're getting me fired up here, dude, because like one of the things I'm obsessed with is emo as a genre, right? Like,
yeah,
I have a strong belief that emo as a genre did not exist until September 11th 2001. That's my opinion, okay? That's my hot take. But there's like Reddit posts where some guy's like, any emo that's not from DC is like fake emo, like all like, because there were the precursor bands. I don't know. They were saying like good emo came from DC. So it's like, you're talking about post hardcore and post punk and stuff like that. So did you grow up in the DC area or you went there for college?
I grew up in New Jersey. Okay. And then went to college in Virginia.
Oh, okay.
So tons of people filtered up to DC.
Cool.
Yeah. Lots of people working for the government.
Very interesting.
Even our lead singer at that point was the press secretary for Senator Tim Johnson of South Dakota, was his job while he wasn't in a jangle pop band.
That's cool, man. I mean, yeah, sure. Yeah. Why not? That's a totally foreign world for me. Like, yeah, we have,
yeah,
it's like, I don't, I, I have a, yeah, well, so sorry, and then shifting topics even more further, well,
yeah.
On the artistic front, okay, you coded an Enigma machine in D3.js.
That was, I mean, back when I was working at Observable,
yeah,
I got kind of obsessed with visualizing like encryption algorithms, and the Enigma machine is such a good one because it's so physical. I mean, it is a physical thing.
It's a physical, what do they call that? A mechanical computer, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Electromechanical computer. And so it actually like rotates as it's working. And so the visualization is trying to be like kind of literal. But yeah, it was fun. It's like it's always a challenge to figure out how to take these things and figure out what the dimensions are going to be. Like that one is kind of like, it's all radial. But there are so many different ways that you could actually visualize it.
So do you like understand how the Enigma machine works? Like building the visualization of it? I'm sure you had to develop a pretty good understanding.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a pretty good understanding of how it works now. But you know, so did the Americans. So it didn't work all that well.
Took them a while to figure it out. I actually have seen an Enigma machine in real life. I went to the there's a museum at the NSA headquarters. It's not like part, it's like outside of the NSA headquarters. Like I think it's the cryptography museum. So I went there and saw an Enigma machine that's the first time I even learned about the Enigma machine, actually. And then, you know, what's the German calculator that looks like a pencil sharpener, but
I don't know.
Anyways, so those kind of things. So you like, I don't know, what do you have any further thoughts on like the Enigma machine and like mechanical computers and all that? Like, I don't know, that you seem like the foremost expert I've ever personally talked to on encryption and Enigma machine and things like that.
I mean, it, all right, I, you know, I guess as it was very clear, don't use a repeated phrase every time that you're using your encryption device for the first time.
Like, is that what happened? You know? That's what.
Yeah. The Germans kept saying like some equivalent of like Heil at the beginning of all of their communications. And since there were only like a set number of configurations of the machine, we were able to work backwards from that. So, you know, there are like three, sometimes four rotors and a bunch of positions that they can be in. And so there are only so many positions. And then if you have like one plain text string or one clear text string that you're sending through it all the time, yeah, you're kind of your host. And so, yeah, like modern encryption, you have just like this big thing, like the initialization vector, usually, which is like the starting state of the algorithm that prevents that from happening. So then even if you have a lot of really similar inputs, you still have unique outputs. That's the idea behind it, at least.
So, okay. I don't want to make you sit here and explain computer science to me, right? but just kind of like for my layman ability, like just like a modern encryption algorithm, like AES 256. Like, I don't know the specifics about that, right? But if I like take a text file and write hello, you're saying that basically modern encryption, like even if I have hello in every text file, if I encrypt that over and over and over again, it will be different. That's the idea.
I think with AES, it'll be the same.
Okay.
But like when we're encrypting stuff, at least internally, there are a bunch of algorithms that have, they produce like, they create a key for every bit of text that you're encrypting, essentially.
Wow.
As well as your secret key.
Wow. Yeah, I think, I mean, honestly, the closest I've ever had to get like up close and personal with encryption, it's not even really encryption, but like how Gravatar hashes work, because it's based on an email and it's privacy protected, because like every email will always end up with the same hash, but you can't go the other way. You can't go back. You can't get, I mean, maybe you, I don't, I mean, it would be hard to crack.
Yeah.
It'd be a while. Right. But
yeah, Gravatars are MD5, which is hashed, which is which has been cracked. So you could probably do it, but it would take a very long time.
Yeah. For an email. It's like, it's on my website anyways, you know? That's really cool. Well, you know, hey, we're kind of coming up on time, and I want to be respectful of your time. I wanted to ask, it's a little bit, I hope this is an okay question. It's a little bit open-ended or bizarre, but what's something you wish someone would ask you about, or you wish you could talk about with somebody more? Like, we're nerds. I say that endearingly. Like, we'll talk people's ears off about random stuff. So maybe it's even just a recent fascination, or maybe it's a lifelong obsession, but is there anything that you wish that you could talk about more?
I mean, I would love to ask you about leaving the tech industry.
Oh, we can get into that if you'd like. Sure. What do you want to know?
I mean, first I'll say it's in the air. I went to the park this weekend and everyone was talking about what their future careers were, and they were all software engineers. All right, so you are both leaving, but also doing something that seems pretty intense. And what drew you to that, I guess? How does that... So you're doing medical of some kind?
No.
Okay.
Okay, what? I attended... I'm a college dropout. I don't have a college degree.
Nice.
I'm a self-taught program. Well, I'm a self-taught programmer. I took some classes in high school, C++ and web development. Got my first kind of little gig in high school doing a website for a local company and other things like that. It was really great, you know. They're actually still around.
Oh, yeah. You're teaching. Sorry. Teaching.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I went to Brigham Young University. I got 3/4 of the way through it. They call it technology education, which basically is like every fun class you ever took in middle school or high school. That's what technology education is. I mean, assuming that you're a nerd like me. So like we were like building trebuchets in college. We were like launching rocket, like bottle, you know, like 2-liter bottle rockets, building bridges, like just doing like bizarre engineering challenges, right? Like literally one of my life's greatest achievements is there was a challenge where you were given like 1 square foot of aluminum foil and like 20 inches of tape and like some random things like that. And the project was you had to design a boat that could carry the most amount of golf balls floating in water before it submersed or tipped over. Right. And it's like interesting when you're like sitting there thinking about it, cause it's like, I don't know, like the math, like, I don't know the physics of like surface tension. I don't know how to calculate that. Right. But I'm just sitting there thinking about it. Like a lot of kids would like build like a tube that like was supposed to go down in the water, but then it just tips over, like the buoyancy and everything is all wrong. And I was like, surface tension is like the thing. Right. So what I designed was like, I literally just took like the 1 square foot and I curved up the edges, like maybe 1/4 inch, 1/2 inch, right? So it was just this like long, flat, square disc thing in the water. And then I taped it to seal it up. And I broke the record by so, like, not even close. Like, it was like the previous record was like 15 golf balls. And I made it like 50. Like, they were like pulling golf balls in. And it was a really fun environment. Like, we were learning how to teach, you know? And so it's like everybody's gathered around like, dude, you're like such a genius. Like, how do you figure this out? You know, it's just stuff like seriously, that was like one of the most like, I just thought that was so rad. And things like that, I have a big passion for teaching and things like that. In my tech career, I dropped out of college to join a startup here in Utah. And one of the most rewarding things I did and have continued to do is develop an internship program. I'd go to universities, I'd recruit kids, like talk to them face to face, like literally pick candidates for web development, mobile development. And a lot of the people that have been on my podcast are my former interns that like,
nice.
I mean, there's a Steve Jobs quote where he says like A players hire A players and B players hire C players. I hate that quote because I think it's false, but like, it's so cool because I hire like these kids that are just geniuses, like so much smarter than I could ever even hope to be. And to see their career trajectory and just what they're able to do in their life by far has been the most rewarding thing. Like making an extra $100. Like, dude, I was at this startup and like we coded a feature that literally was like pumping in money hand over fist. Like it was just additional revenue on top of the product we already offered. And it's like, do you think that like anybody even gives a crap about that now? Like, do you think that like the CEO, whoever was making that money, or the venture capitalists that were invested, they didn't give a crap, dude. Like they could, it's like, it's just another number on the Excel spreadsheet saying whatever. I don't even know, man. It just feels totally void of meaning. But man, those relationships that I built with those people, and then to see the careers that they continue to have, the lives that they've been able to develop, and just kind of have that freedom, working with early career people was just so thrilling to me. And then so recently, well, not recently, in 2020, I joined another startup based out of California, and everything went great. Dude, that founding team, they were so awesome. Like, these guys have like their name in the Firefox source code from the 90s, like worked on the WebKit team for Apple, like during the transition of when Steve Jobs, so like very, very experienced developers. Not necessarily like the greatest code ever written, you know, or anything like that, but like code never quality is. And business success kind of seem to, I mean, it has to be good enough, but like, it's not like better code is going to make you more successful. It's more abstract than that. I don't even understand. But, you know, so everything went well. We got acquired by a publicly traded company. And then the publicly traded company got acquired by a private equity firm and taken private. So it worked out well for me financially with my options and everything. You know, like I always treat that stuff as just monopoly money. Like maybe it'll be worth something, but probably not. I mean, we're there for the salary. And then it turned into like just a really chill, stable job, kind of just supporting this. I mean, honestly, my job became, I just want to help the company get the most value they possibly can out of their acquisition. And I did that for a couple of years and kind of one day just like woke up and was like, I just can't do it, man. I just can't freaking do it. And it was reckless and stupid and it's not glamorous, man. Like, it's scary right now. I've got a good support system. You know, my wife and I have a really great relationship. We've been married for, I think we've been married for 13 years. There's been opportunities like to, to pull in, you know, just more money. But the thing right now is that, I dropped out cause I couldn't force myself to take generals, man. Like I just like, I couldn't do it, man. I just could not do it. So I've got generals I got to finish up. I can do that online. And, I've got a training later this week and I want to start substitute teaching high school and middle school. My plan is I want to get into the schools, make an impact with kids' lives. Cause I think that that is like, look, I can go into the classroom and make a difference in a person's life. Like will affect, like I had a high school teacher who taught me how to program and look like that's made my entire life what it is. And I can return the favor and it doesn't matter what my principal or the boss or the person paying my paycheck, if the taxpayers paying my paycheck decide that public education is a waste of money, like those kids, the impact has been made. And that's my motivation. Now sounds glamorous, but it's scary, dude. Like it's terrifying walking away from a staff software engineer salary, benefits. Currently I don't even have health insurance. You know, I've got money saved up in my HSA. So it's like, we're okay. But it's like, yeah, dude, it's like really, really, really freaking scary. So I don't know. I just read Of Mice and Men by Steinbeck, and the saying, you know, the best laid plans of mice and men quickly go to ruin, or whatever it is. I have reservations. You know, there's like this kind of pet peeve I have personally and with other people where it's like, it's a lot more fun and easy to announce that you're going to do something, but then the follow through. There's actually a quote by Ben Franklin from the almanac he used to publish. 'Tis easy to make a good, to frame a good, bold resolution, but hard is the task that concerns the execution. So we'll have to see how I execute on it, dude. But the thing is like, I just want to keep my options open, my eyes open. I am a good teacher, like, and I'm a good engineer as well. Like, everything I've ever tried to do in my life, from entrepreneurship to college or whatever it is, we, you know, we talked earlier about success and even like, how do you even measure that personally, right? It's not a number in a bank account. It's not lines of code or whatever. I don't know. Like, it's just, maybe it's personal satisfaction. Maybe it's making a difference in your community. I know that I'll be successful. I don't know how gnarly the path will be though. You know, like, I don't know, you know, I don't know how gnarly it's going to get, but, I also want to not acknowledge kind of the, I guess, the privileged place I'm able to come at this from, because, you know, I guess I have put in the, you know, I've been a professional engineer for over a decade. I've had a lot of people that have stuck their neck out for me personally and made a difference in my family's life too. And actually, for fun fact, the place that I found that most recent startup that I joined was Hacker News Who's Hiring. So it's like,
nice.
They weren't a YC company or anything. It's just they had investors, but yeah. So Hacker News personally has made an impact on my life, the Who's Hiring, but I don't know, man, what else do you want to know?
Oh, I think it's cool. Like even people with as much privileges as you have will be in the same circumstance and still never exert the force of will that you have just to make the, decision, right?
Like, oh, I think, dude, maybe, but it feels crazy. It feels reckless, dude. It feels like, look, man, I have a bipolar diagnosis and I go see a therapist like every other week. And it's like, I literally sit here and I ask myself, like, am I crazy? Like, am I crazy? Like this, I go and talk to my therapist. Like, I mean, this sounds like something a crazy person would do, right? Like, am I crazy? I honestly, I don't know. I hope I'm not, but, I don't know. I guess you trust yourself, you trust God and the universe or whatever you want to call it. You, like you said, you write down things when they get gnarly. It kind of seems like in retrospect, most things that you're worried about, you probably don't really need to be that worried about unless you're going 45 miles an hour on an e-bike down a sidewalk. Maybe you should be worried about that, but yeah.
I think it's awesome. Teaching is hard as hell, but I think you can do it. It's like also the combination of being very good at engineering and very good at teaching is not that common. Yeah. And so I really wish that more of the people who could do that were doing it.
Yes. Because man, it's like, dude, that's the worst thing. That's why I couldn't take generals, man. 'Cause it's like, I don't know. Like, it's like you'll go in for the final, the midterm, and it's like written by the teacher. And it's like, there'll be stuff on there that's like, if not like false, like just incorrect, like, or unfalsifiable, you know, like how could you even know this? But it's like the curriculum I have to learn and it's taught, like it's bad. But you know, one thing I like to say is we criticize the youth, the kids these days, right? The criticism you'll hear people say is everybody just wants to be a social media influencer or a YouTuber. But guess what, man? Knowing how to make video content, knowing how to like have proper audio and use Final Cut or whatever it is, knowing how to, like, you know, you can see I myself am a big musician. I'm primarily a drummer, but I've been learning a lot more bass, but I do it all in Logic. And I want to teach kids all that, man. I want to teach them how to blog. I want to teach them why it's worthwhile to do that. It's like we fill up high schools with 3D printers and act like that's worthwhile. But it's like, man, I want to teach kids how to use that stuff. I 3D print random geometric shapes, nice. You know, like Yeah, I want to make people's lives better with technology. I don't want to just shoehorn LLM features into whatever product because management thinks it's cool. Yeah.
Everyone complains about the kids, but you're potentially going to do something about the kids, you know?
I just want to help them because, dude, the thing is, kids are so, like, good. Like, they are. Yeah. The bad people are the people with money, in my opinion. Like, I'm not saying anybody with money is bad, but, like, it's unethical from my perspective
to be a billionaire. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, but kids, it's like, hey, man, I want to start my SoundCloud mumble rap career. And it's like, let's go, dude. Like, 100%. Like, open up Logic. Here you go. What aesthetic are you going for? You can literally record it on your iPhone. My favorite band, King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard, has recorded entire albums just with their iPhones. Hasn't a sound aesthetic to it. It has value to it, you know? Like, or, dude, you want to go in and make little beat loops in Logic or whatever app you want to do? Like, I want to show you how to use DistroKid and get it on streaming or whatever you need to figure out. Make a blog, make a Bandcamp. I don't know, like, teen mom, it's like, were you just screwing around or like that stuff is valuable? I wouldn't listen to it, dude. Like, it's cool and you never know. So yeah, thanks.
Yeah. And we got there because my college's library had a recording studio in the basement. So
really,
thanks to those librarians, you know?
Really?
Yeah.
Dude, that's,
otherwise I don't think I would have gotten into music seriously.
That's awesome. I'm an Eagle Scout, Boy Scouts of America, and I don't know, whatever, but like the best part about being an Eagle Scout, a Boy Scout, is they basically just force you to like learn about random crap, like fingerprinting. Yeah. But for me, it's more like just possibilities. Like, and maybe that's kind of the discussion that we're hovering around with social media and the algorithm based stuff is like, it's just so homogenized, you know, it's so like, there's one thing, like how many views do you have? How many subscribers do you have? Like, that's what's valuable. And it's just so not true, man. Like, doing paintings that you feel like are objectively not that good of art, like, but putting them on your website, it's so worth it. It's so awesome. I can look at your fish trousers and it's like, this is so cool. I love it. Yeah. So thanks a lot.
Yeah. 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 It's been awesome.
Well, let's go ahead. Do you have any, let's wrap it up. Do you have any closing thoughts or statements you want to share before we hop off?
No, I feel like this has been great. I like this this format. I feel like a lot of lore. You have multiple blog posts that are just like lore, right?
Lore drop. It's kind of a meme between me and my friends, lore drop.
Yeah. It's a great category. I love it.
I love people's lore, and that's why I like doing this, man. And I like nerds. I like people that are passionate about things. So I really, really appreciate you being willing to come on and just like talk to me, man. Like, open up and I find it all really fascinating. So thank you, and keep up the awesome work, man. Keep up the work on the blog. We didn't even get a chance to talk about professional work, but just keep at it, man. Like, I'm here for it. I don't know that much about cycling, but I enjoy your posts. I don't know much about photography, but I enjoy your posts. So just keep it up. I really, really, I personally, from the bottom of my heart, I really appreciate you sharing, taking the time to share on your website and elsewhere.
Yeah. And I hope you start writing about teaching. It'll be fun.
Hopefully I can. Hopefully my plans don't go to ruin so quickly that I never even get the chance. But I'll try. I'll keep that in mind. Thank you. My rule is like, cool. I'll do it if literally one person asks me to. So you just asked me to. So I'll do it.
Excellent.
Interrobang.